Blog Talk Radio.
Interesting, folks. Sorry about the delay. We were a little bit late in getting started. Had some technical difficulties here with the internet once again. But I think at some time we'll get all these bugs worked out and we'll actually be able to get things running the way they should. But I think we're up and running now. Good evening. We're up to lesson number 65 in our study of the Book of Acts. This is your host, Andy Young, and I want to thank you once again for joining us on Blog Talk Radio for another Tuesday night Bible study. Happy Election Day to everyone, those of you listening in the United States. Hopefully you all went out and voted today. I guess I can't stress the importance of getting out to vote. Let me just get a couple things off my chest that are on my mind right now since it is an election Tuesday. I did go out to vote, by the way, and just a couple things that have been kind of simmering with me all day long here. I need an outlet to kind of vent these things. But first of all, taxes. I will never, I don't know if I want to say never, but yeah, I guess I simply cannot, am unable to understand why somebody would willingly vote to have raise their own taxes. Why would you vote to raise your own taxes? That's the first thing. The second thing, here in Ohio, we had several state issues on the ballot that we had to vote for today. Now, let me start out by saying this. A few years ago, there was an issue on the ballot. There was a big casino developer from Indiana who wanted to open casinos here in Ohio, but current Ohio state law made it illegal for casinos to operate. So they drafted a ballot initiative that would make casino gambling legal in the state of Ohio. Okay, fine. I'm not going to get into the evils or the perceived evils or not of about gambling. But the problem with this legislation was that it made casino gambling legal by virtue of a constitutional amendment to the state constitution. Not only that, the language in the constitutional amendment was specific to have four casinos built in one casino built in four specific locations within the state of Ohio. So basically, it was only going to benefit this one corporate entity who wanted to build these casinos. And this developer invested millions of dollars to have this issue put on the ballot. People voted for it. It passed. Now, this time around, they want to do the same thing with legalizing marijuana. And again, we could talk about the issue of whether marijuana should be legal or not, or its benefits, its harm. That's not the issue. What I have a problem with, again, is here, once again, you have a handful of corporate entities who are seeking to have marijuana legalized by amending the state constitution specifically for their own benefit. You've got 10 corporate individuals that would allow, they would be the only ones allowed to have marijuana farms in 10 specific locations throughout the state of Ohio. Now, folks, again, whether or not you think marijuana should be legal or not is not the issue. My issue is, if you're going to legalize it, this is not the way you do it. You do not amend the Constitution of the state to get this kind of thing passed. And you certainly don't do it so that a small handful of people benefit from it. That is the definition of tyranny. When you've got power in the control of a small handful of people. And that was the big issue. So that's why I did vote for this issue. And I really hope that it falls through. Things that I've been hearing on the radio here lately have said that the opposition against those who are for this issue passing is something like 10-1. So hopefully people get out and vote today. I know when I went to the poll this evening, the parking lot was jam-packed. And I live in a small rural area, so we'll see what happens with that. So, like I said, I just wanted to get that off my chest and have a little just kind of vent that out there. Go ahead and take your Bibles, turn to Acts chapter 27, and while you're turning there, the phone number, if you'd like to be a part of the program, again is area code 347-855-8317. You can use your Skype account if you want to join the program, log in using your Skype account. You can send us an email at mail@ttanc.com. That's mail@ttank.com. You can scroll down to the bottom of the program screen and enter any comments you wish there as well. And again, I apologize for the delay and the technical issues I had here at the beginning. We won't get into that. Hopefully, those of you who want to listen on the program live tonight have found your way to the new link on the Blog Talk Radio screen. And we'll go ahead and later on, I'll upload this audio for this podcast to the original episode link that's there on the program screen. So if you have your Bibles and you're turning to Acts chapter 27, we will pick up where we left off from last week with verse 27, and we'll work our way through all the way to the end of the chapter. Tonight's lesson is going to be very much like last week's. I'm going to offer very little in the way of any sort of theological or doctrinal teaching. I'm just going to work through these verses and examine the events as they unfold before us and simply offer some commentary on the historical background and significance of these things. There will be opportunities as we go along to clarify some traditional misconceptions about what has traditionally been taught with some of these passages. More specifically, when we get to a certain portion of text, we will see how that text is used if one is using a redemptive historical method of interpretation versus a grammatical historical one. And really, that is an easy trap to fall into. I made mention of this last week. We have been so conditioned to looking for some doctrinal significance in every verse of scripture that we end up, and the phrase I used was spiritualizing. We end up spiritualizing the passage. That is, the temptation is to go out of our way to give the passage some deeper doctrinal application that was never intended by the author. And this is what leads to error. This is what you end up doing when you use a redemptive approach rather than a grammatical approach. This is the difference between eisegesis and exegesis. And I struggled with that last week, as I mentioned. And I had to work just to simply recount the events as they happen and explain them from a grammatical standpoint and nothing more. And so we're going to do the same thing again this week. Now, if you want to make any kind of personal application, you're more than welcome to do that. I'm not going to stop you. But I'm not going to sit here and take any kind of dogmatic position on any given interpretation and say, yes, this is how we should apply this. This is what this passage really means. Okay? I'm not going to do that. I don't have the authority to do that. Now let's review. Where are we? Last week we looked at a centurion by the name of Julius. This centurion who was given custody of Paul to accompany him on his way to Rome. And there are very few times where a Gentile, and even more specifically a Roman soldier, is given so much, we're given so much specifics about him in Scripture. The fact that he's mentioned by name is significant. We saw once again the significance of Paul's citizenship as a Roman, the role that played, how that was a benefit to him, how that was significant in allowing him to have much freedom, even though he was under arrest, even though he was in Roman custody. His citizenship afforded him certain rights and privileges. We spent some time looking at the kind of sailing vessel that they were traveling in. We compared the difference between a merchant ship that they were traveling in and how that was different from a warship and how this would have affected their travel. The fact that it actually slowed them down, that they didn't make the kind of progress that they were hoping to make. The time of year came into play. They began their journey in the fall, going into the time of season where sailing was dangerous and generally discouraged. Okay, and even Paul himself warned them. He said, "I don't think it's a good time that we set sail now." You know, they had made port in the fair havens on the island of Crete. And Paul said to them, he said, "Hey, I perceive this is not a good time for us to sail." You know, and that was no enlightenment from God. That was Paul speaking from his own personal experience, his own knowledge. Okay? We saw how he did not necessarily receive any kind of message or enlightenment from God regarding this warning not to go. You know, the reason they left Crete when they did, they had a favorable south wind come up, you know, and we looked at the map and we saw that this south wind was actually a result of a very strong low pressure system that was building there in the Mediterranean that worked itself up into this hurricane, and how these winds were rotating in this counterclockwise direction. And once they got caught up in it, it started blowing them westward, taking them around. Okay. And then once they were inside this hurricane and the force of it, how they had to haul in the dinghy and secure it inside the ship, and how they took these, what are called, they were called helps, but these ropes and chains, and they wrapped the ship. They wrapped these chains around the bottom of the hull from one side to the other to reinforce the hull and secure it, to protect it, to hold the ship together. in these stormy seas. And then we looked at Paul's message that he got from an angel, a messenger from God. Specifically in verse 24, where the angel told him specifically that God has given the lives, everyone there, over to Paul. He said, I've given them all to you, and there's going to be no loss of life, because it's necessary, Paul, for you to get to Rome. It's necessary for you to get to Rome. So don't fear. And the men took great courage from that. They were very encouraged from that. They had hope. Okay? So that brings us to where we are now. We're going to pick up then from that point. Paul told them, the last thing we saw was Paul said, yes, we're all going to survive. We're all going to live. But we are going to end up cast upon some certain island. And so now we pick up in verse 27. So why don't you follow along with me as I read Acts chapter 27, starting in verse 27. But when the 14th night was come, as we were driven up and down in Adria, or Adria, however you want to say that, about midnight, the shipmen deemed that they drew near to some country, and sounded and found it 20 fathoms. And when they had gone a little further, they sounded again and found it 15 fathoms. Then fearing lest we should have fallen upon rocks, notice the we there, okay, that inclusive personal plural pronoun we, okay, so obviously Luke is writing from a first person perspective here. Luke is with them on this voyage. Lest we should have fallen upon rocks, they cast four anchors out of the stern, that's the back of the boat, and wished for the day. Now, let's look at where we are. I provided you a map with last week's lesson, and I've included that same map again tonight in the slideshow. And hopefully it's big enough for you to be able to see. But you have that map there, and I've showed you the low pressure system with the arrows rotating in the counterclockwise direction. And these storm tracks, because of the rotation of the Earth is rotating from west to east. That means the storm is going to track from east to west as the Earth rotates underneath it. And that storm is carrying them in a westward direction. In a westerly direction, you'll notice there in the map, you can see where it says at the top there, it says Adria or Ionian Sea. Okay, and that's the sea that they're traveling through. And so picture them. Here they are. They're riding up and down in these huge swells that are driven up by the storm. Okay, and they're moving in this westward direction. And about midnight, they think they see land off in the distance. And then it says they sounded. They sounded. Now, sounded here has nothing to do with the word, with actual sound in the sense of a noise or tone. The King James Version usage of sounded here is actually comes from an old English word, sund, that has to do with meaning to swim or having to do with the sea. Okay, but the Greek word there is the word bolidzo, and what bolidzo means is to cast the lead. Okay, to cast the lead. Now, this is what they did. They have a long chain or rope, and at the end of this is a very large, heavy lead weight. And this chain is marked at certain intervals. And they would cast this lead weight with this chain into the sea and let it drop down until it hit the bottom. And wherever it hit, then they could look at what the marks, where the marks are on the chain, and therefore they could determine the depth of the water at that particular point. Okay, so when it says they sounded, this is what they did. They cast this lead weight with this chain into the water to take a depth reading. And the first time they did it, The first time they did it, they came up with a depth of 20 fathoms. Now, a fathom, the word there for fathom is the word orguia. Orguia. And it means a stretch of the arms. Now, if you were to stretch your arms out to your side, like you're getting ready to give somebody a big hug, okay, that's a stretch of the arms. That's the general distance of a fathom. And it's generally accepted, was accepted to be about 6 feet. Okay. You figure an average person, an average man is around 6 feet tall. And so his arm span would be about 6 feet. So that's the distance of a fathom. Okay. That's where we get the measurement from, referring to this stretch of the arms. So 20 fathoms is about 120 feet. And then they went a little bit further and they cast the lead in again. They took another depth measurement, and this time it was 15 fathoms. That's about 90 feet. So they've gone a short distance, and already now the depth of the sea has risen, or has actually lessened by about 30 feet. It's 30 feet less deep than it was before. Obviously, they figure, well, they must be getting pretty close to land now since the water's starting to get more shallow here. Now, when they did this sounding, when they cast the lead into the water, obviously the first obvious reason for doing this is for safety measures, to be able to tell how close they're getting to land. They want to know how deep the water is. But they would actually also use this for navigation purposes, because they had various depths plotted out on their navigational charts and their maps, and they could generally tell where they were by the depth of the sea in any given location. The other thing that they would do is this lead weight that they had at the bottom of it was usually coated with tallow. Now, if you don't know what tallow is a fat made from rendered beef fat. It's rendered beef fat. And they would coat this lead weight with this fat, this tallow. And when they would drop it in the water, when it hit the bottom, if the bottom of the sea was sandy or silty, it would stick to the tallow. And they would know that the bottom of the sea was sandy. If it came up clean, that would tell them that the bottom was rocky. So this is useful. So dropping this lead weight into the water served many purposes for them. So in this instance, they're approaching this land. They can tell the depth is getting shallower, they're getting closer to land. It's midnight, it's still dark, they can't really see where they're going to navigate. Throw anchors out the back of the boat to hold themselves in place. And then it says they wished for the day. They wished for the day. That's an interesting expression. They wished for the day. The word there is the Greek word eukomai. Eukomai. It's the same word we get the word Eucharist from. Now, a Eucharist is simply a prayer of thanks or thanksgiving. So it comes from the same root word here. It has to do with praying. Eukomai. In this sense, these guys were praying. So when it says they wished for the day, they were praying. Now, let me ask you, who were they praying to? Who were they praying to? Well, obviously, if these guys are Romans, if they're Hellenized, we could most likely assume that they were praying to their plurality of various sundry gods or whoever they pray to. That's one possibility. But put yourself in a scenario like this. If any of you have kids, if you've ever been up all night with a sick child, I mean really sick, really, really sick, and you can't sleep, the child can't sleep, they're miserable, and you're just up all night with them, and you think to yourself, if I can just get them through the night, we'll be fine for morning to get here. Why? Because you know that once you get to morning, you have this feeling that things will be better once the daylight comes. Okay? In that sense, you're wishing for the day. You're praying for day to come. And that's the same situation that these sailors and everyone on this boat find themselves in. They threw out the anchors and just wished for the day. They couldn't wait for the daytime to get there because they figured it's got to get better by daytime. Now look at what happens here in verse 30. And as the shipmen were about to flee out of the ship, when they had let down the boat into the sea, under color as though they would have cast anchors out of the foreship, Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, "Except these abide in the ship, ye cannot be saved." And then the soldiers cut off the ropes of the boat and let her fall off. All right. This is interesting what's going on here. Let me stop here and say this, that this is one of those examples where someone might take this passage and choose to interpret it in a redemptive historical manner. Except these abide in the ship. Except these abide in the ship. And you know, I've actually, and I've mentioned this before, I've actually heard lessons taught from this passage, from using this verse, making all kinds of analogies about what the ship represents and how we have to abide in the ship in order to be saved. You know, and our salvation is dependent upon abiding in the ship. Okay? And Paul is saying, except these abide in the ship. But if we look closely at this passage, okay, now I know that sounds silly. I know that sounds silly, but you know what? This is not outside of the realm of possibilities if you use a redemptive historical approach to interpreting scripture. This becomes a perfectly reasonable interpretation. Okay? But look closely at this passage. Look closely at what Luke is telling us here. And we'll see why this is wrong. First of all, look at verse 30. What group of people is verse 30 talking about? What is the group of people being referenced in verse 30? It's the shipmen. The shipmen. The crew. Okay? Maybe including the captain. Maybe even the owner of the ship. Remember, we saw last week that it was the captain and the owner of the ship, perhaps even the person who he probably even owned the cargo that was being transported. They all convinced the centurion to launch from Crete. Remember that? So we could probably even throw the owner of the ship in with this group of people, the shipmen. What are these guys trying to do? Well, it says they're trying to flee. Okay, but look carefully at this, or you're going to miss this. Look carefully at this. Look at this little phrase here, under color. I don't know what it says in the ESV or New American Standard or any of these other translations, but the King James says under color. Under color. Now, when you look up that word in the Greek, and what that actually means, the word used there in the Greek actually means to make a pretense. To make a pretense. What were they making a pretense of? In other words, What were they pretending to do? Okay? They were pretending as if they were going to go to the front of the ship and let out more anchors, weren't they? You see that? They're making it appear to everyone else that, oh, we're just going to go up here to the front of the ship and we're going to throw out some more anchors in the front of the ship. But what were they really doing instead? You remember last week we said one of the first things they did once they got in the middle of the storm is they did what? They secured the dinghy. Remember? They brought the dinghy up on board, they tied it down, they secured it. What these guys are doing is they're getting ready to lower the dinghy down into the water so they can get in and abandon the ship. Okay? They're trying to lower the dinghy to so they can escape and abandon everybody else on board, aren't they? Under this pretense that, oh, we're just lowering anchors, don't mind us, pay no attention to what we're doing, okay? But guess what? Paul saw what they were doing. Paul saw what they were doing, and he brought it to the attention of the centurion. He says, do you see what they're doing over there? And what's he saying? Paul says, you better not let those guys go. If you let those guys get away, we're not going to make it through this alive. Okay? Except these, referring to the shipmen who are trying to escape and abandon them all. Paul is saying, unless those guys stay here with us, we're not going to make it through this. You see that? So Paul's saying to the centurion, hey, don't let those guys get away. They need this. We need them here. We need them here. And you can, and you think back to Paul's other message earlier about the vision he had, about the messenger, when he told about the messenger from God who told them they're all going to make it out of here alive. Okay? You put those together, and Paul is saying, hey, we're going to make it out of here alive, but we need those guys to do it. Okay? I think it's interesting that it's Paul's just not relying here on fate or some kind of deterministic outcome. Well, just because God said it's going to happen doesn't mean we don't need to take action here. Okay? God says we're going to make it out of here alive. But we need those guys. We need the crew. You can't let the crew get away. We need the crew here if we're going to do this, if this is going to happen. All right. So what ends up happening then is the centurion sees it, and he kind of reels those guys in, and he says, uh-uh, you guys aren't going to escape. You're not going to abandon us. And so the centurion commands the soldiers. He says, so these guys can't try this again. We're going to cut the dinghy loose. You see that? That's exactly what happened. He says they cut off the ropes of the boat and they let her fall off. Okay? So they got rid of the dinghy so that the shipmen couldn't try to escape again and abandon them. And that was probably a wise thing for him to do. All right. Let's go on here. Verse 33. And while the day was coming on, okay, it's getting closer to morning now. The sun's getting ready to rise. Paul besought them all to take meat, saying, this day is the 14th day that ye have tarried and continued fasting, having taken nothing. Wherefore, I pray you, take some meat, for this is for your health. For there shall not an hair fall from the head of any of you. And when he had thus spoken, he took bread and gave thanks to God in presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. And then they were all of good cheer. And they also took some meat. And we were in all in the ship 216 souls. 14 days. They've been in this storm from the time they left Crete 14 days since any of them have eaten. Okay? They haven't. Now, why didn't they eat? Because, you know, it says they have tarried. The word there for tarried means waiting in anticipation, waiting in anticipation. They were waiting for the storm to pass. They were thinking, oh, this is going to blow over soon. We'll be out of this in no time. We can wait to eat. We need to focus all of our attention now on the ship and keeping everything together through the storm. We're not going to stop to eat now while we're in the middle of this. And so they kept waiting and waiting. Oh, another day. Oh, still storming. And these guys haven't eaten anything because the storm hasn't let up. And now 14 days later, they still haven't eaten anything. And Paul says, I pray you, take some meat, take some nourishment. This is for your health. You guys need to be strong. You need to get your strength up. Okay? Look at this phrase. For there shall not an hair fall from the head of any of you. This I don't think is an indication of some kind of precognition or foreknowledge on Paul's part. What this is Paul taking responsibility for these men. This is like a father saying to his children, guys, eat something. You need to keep your strength up. I don't want you guys to get sick. I want you guys to be strong. This is a very powerful statement on Paul feeling responsible for these men. Remember, after all, God told Paul specifically, I've given them all into your hands, right? I've given them all into your hands. So Paul's feels a great sense of responsibility for these people on this ship. And so he says, guys, will you please eat something? Keep your strength up. I want you to be so strong and healthy that not one hair is going to fall out of your head. Okay? Wonderful, wonderful insight into Paul's character here and his responsibility that he feels for these men. And what makes this even more interesting is when you consider that Paul is a prisoner on this ship. He is a prisoner on this ship, and he is the one serving them. He is the one serving them. Look what it says. It's like he took bread. He took the initiative. He took bread. And before he did anything else, what does he do? He gives thanks to God. And the King James, says, in their presence, right there in front of them, he did this. He wasn't shy about it. He didn't go off into a corner. He didn't, he was just like, hey, I want these guys to see that I am giving thanks to God for what we have, for where we are, and for the fact that I know I can trust him. And so he stops right where he is. He takes a loaf of bread and he takes a bite off, he takes a piece off of it and he stops right there. And again, the word is a Eucharist. In the Greek, the word is Eucharist, a prayer of thanksgiving, right there in front of all of the people on board. And he began to eat. He didn't wait for them. He just like, look, you guys need to eat. Here's some bread. Look, I'm going to eat something. He thanks God, and he begins eating. He's leading them by example. He is setting the example for them to follow. And notice that the rest of the guys, the rest of the people on board, didn't start to eat until Paul did. Paul had to start eating first. And they were actually encouraged by the mere fact of seeing Paul sitting down to stop and eat something. it was almost as if they needed that assurance that everything was going to be okay. Because remember, all this time, they're saying, we're in the middle of a storm. We can't stop to eat. But now Paul is saying, hey, it's okay to take a break. It's okay. We can stop for a minute and eat something. And that example was a tremendous encouragement to these people on the ship. And once he did that, all the rest of them began to eat. How many were there? 276 people. 276 people on board that ship. Let's go on. Verse 38. And when they had eaten enough, they lighted the ship and cast out the wheat into the sea. And when it was day, they knew not the land, but they discovered a certain creek with a shore into which they were minded, if it were possible, to thrust in the ship. And when they had taken up the anchors, they committed themselves unto the sea and loosed the rudder bands and hoisted up the mainsail to the wind and made toward shore. And falling into a place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground, and the forepart stuck fast and remained unmovable, but the hinder part was broken with the violence of the waves. All right, look at what happens here. Not only did they take a break to eat, they ate until they were full. This wasn't just a little snack these guys were having. They haven't eaten in 14 days. These guys really ate. They ate until they had eaten enough. And then once they did that, they threw everything else overboard. They said, okay, guys, this is it. It's all or nothing. And they threw everything else overboard. And, you know, earlier we could see that they had done this once already when they first found themselves in this storm. I mean, they threw out all the vessels, all the tackling, all the equipment necessarily for sailing. They threw out a lot of the cargo, perhaps much of the furnishings on board. Now they're throwing out the very last of the cargo. And the word here is wheat, but this is a rather generic term. It could refer to any kind of grain, actually. It doesn't matter with wheat or corn. It could even be milled flour, for that matter. Other provisions, any other kind of provisions that they had on board for feeding the crew and the passengers, they threw it all overboard. And then it says they knew not the land. Okay? This was unfamiliar to them. They didn't know where they were. They just saw this piece of land at midnight. And then once the sun came up, they saw it as like, oh, okay, we're not where we thought we were. We have no idea where we are, do we? Okay. And you see here, there's a reference here in the King James. It talks about a creek with a shore. They saw a creek with a shore. That's very unclear in the King James. When you look at this in the Greek, the words there that are used in the Greek, more accurately, this would describe a bay or a gulf that has a sandy beach on it. Okay? So from their location where they were anchored out at sea, they looked out and they could identify from their location. They say, oh, look, there's a gulf, there's a bay over there, and it's got a sandy shore. Let's head that way. Now, why do you think they want to head there? Let's think about this. Why do they want to head there? They don't know where they are, so first of all, they don't know if there's any ports nearby. Okay? They're completely lost. So there's no ports that they know of that they could sail into. Second of all, they don't have the dinghy. Remember? The centurion had the soldiers cut away the dinghy. Okay? The dinghy's gone. So they've got no other way to transport the passengers from the ship to the shore. So the only thing they have, the only option they have left at this point is just sail the ship and run it aground. Okay? That's the only way that they can get close enough to get off this ship is to run it aground. And so they see, hey, there's a bay over there. And it's got a nice sandy shore. Let's run it in there. Okay? We don't want to run into rocks. Okay, if we're going to run this ship aground, the best place to do is going to be on a sandy shore. So that's what they're trying to do here. Run this ship into the sandy shore. And then it says so look what they did. What did they do? They took up the anchors and they committed themselves into the sea. It's now or never. This is our one shot. Let's go for it. And they hoisted up the mainsail, and then it says they loosed the rudder bands. They loosed the rudder bands. And one of the other pictures that I included in last week's slideshow, and I included it once again in this week's slideshow, was a picture of a common merchant ship this is most likely the type of ship that they were sailing in. Please notice, if you look in that picture at that diagram of the merchant ship, you'll see there at the back of the ship, you'll see these two things that look like oars. Actually, you could probably only see one of them, but there'd be one on either side. The ships of this kind did not actually have a rudder like we're familiar with on boats, where you have a rudder at the back of the ship for steering. They actually steered the boat using these two large oars, one on either side. And when they were not in use, these oars would have been secured up on the deck. And of course, going through this storm, that's one of the things they would have done, and they would have secured those oars. So now we can see they're getting ready to actually try to navigate, to steer the ship. They put up the sails to catch the wind. They loose the rudder bands whatever they were using to secure these oars. So now they can steer the ship to the direction that they want to go. Got that? And then they ended up going into an area where two seas met. Again, this is another very unfortunate way that the King James translates this. The King James Version uses a lot of words to translate one single word in the Greek. And the word that's used in the Greek here refers to a channel. Okay, but what it's describing is a narrow passage of water that connects two larger passages of water. Okay, that's what a channel is, right? So they end up going through a channel in the process. Now, once again, please look at the slideshow that I've included in with this lesson on the program screen. And there is a close-up of the island of Melita, which today is called Malta. Okay, you'll see it says Malta. What I want you to notice there is on kind of like the northeast side of that larger island, you notice, you see the arrow where I'm pointing to St. Paul's Island. Notice that there are two large areas or bays or gulfs there. This is where it is believed that they were trying to steer this ship, probably into one of those two bays. I'm not sure which one. Okay. But one of those two bays is probably where they were trying to steer the ship into. And if you look closely, what I've indicated there by pointing to what I've labeled St. Paul's Island, very, very, very small island. It's less than 1 square kilometer in size, in reality. Very tiny island. But there is a small channel between those, that little tiny island, and the larger mainland. You see that? There's a channel between there, between the larger sea and the bay that they're trying to sail into. Most likely, if we had to speculate here, most likely this is where they're going through. All right, when you have this reference to where two seas met, going through this channel, most likely that's where they went through. See that? And what ended up happening is they got into that channel and they hit shallow ground and the front part of the ship stuck. And the water was so violent there because you've got all this water trying to rush through this channel. Once the front part stuck, the back of the ship wanted to keep going, and it was just too much stress for the ship to handle, and it just broke right in half once it hit. So now it's every man for himself. Let's look at what happens. Let's read on, verse 42. And the soldiers' counsel was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim out and escape. But the centurion, willing to save Paul, kept them from their purpose and commanded that they which could swim should cast themselves first into the sea and get to land. And the rest, some on boards and some on broken pieces of the ship. And so it came to pass that they escaped all safe to land. Look at how the centurion has sort of taken control here. Do you see that? You notice that? The captain of the ship and his crew are no longer in charge, are they? And I'm sure that has a lot to do with the fact that they tried to escape earlier, right? You know, they made that attempt to flee the ship. Now the captain says, all right, that's it. I'm in charge now. You guys aren't going to try this again. So this centurion, he's got quite a job on his hands. Because not only does he have to keep the ship's crew in line, but he also has to see to his own soldiers. And notice here that the soldiers advise the centurion to kill the prisoners before they try to escape. And now they all need to escape, but here the idea is they're worried about the prisoners escaping their custody. They say, hey, we're in big trouble if these prisoners get away, you know. Because under normal circumstances, if a prisoner escaped, the soldiers are responsible for those prisoners. Okay? And what that meant was if any of those prisoners escaped, the soldiers would have been put to death for it. If a prisoner escaped. You remember what happened with the Philippian jailer? When Paul and Silas were in prison in Philippi? And there was the earthquake, and the jailer saw all the cell doors open. And he says, oh no, all my prisoners have escaped. And he was about to kill himself, wasn't he? Why? Because he knew if his prisoners were gone, it was going to be his death. And he was as good as dead anyway. And so he's like, I might as well kill myself. So we have this precedent. We've seen this precedent before. And so the soldiers say, hey, it's better to kill the prisoners than to have them escape and us being the ones ending up dead. Okay? So they try to get the upper hand on the situation here. But what we also need to notice here is the way in which Paul and the centurion work together. It's almost as if Paul can assure that the prisoners aren't going to try to escape. I think the centurion knows this. Think about what this centurion has learned about Paul during all this time. You remember we speculated last week that this centurion was probably present during Paul's last testimony before Agrippa. Because Paul was immediately given over to his custody, and he was put on a ship going to Rome. And he's been sailing with Paul all this time, and he's had all this opportunity to witness Paul and witness his behavior and get to know him and understand his character. And because of this, the centurion has plenty of reason for not wanting to kill Paul. He's come to believe Paul. He's come to trust Paul. On the one hand, he looks at Paul as his own ticket out of all this mess. Okay? He made the unfortunate decision of listening to the captain and the owner of the ship and launching from Crete when Paul said, "I don't think it's a good idea." And now they're in this mess as a result of it. And he probably thinks that if he kills Paul, then none of them are going to get out of this. Okay? You know, he's got this in the back of his mind. He's still remembering what Paul said. He had a messenger from his God come and tell him, "We're all going to make it through this alive." You know, he's remembering what Paul told him. So why would I kill Paul? He's the one that says, "We're going to get out of this." But you know, on the other hand, I think he knows intuitively that that would be the wrong thing to do. Killing Paul would just be the wrong thing to do. I think we've seen this centurion is a man of character. He's going to do the right thing. He's not going to allow anyone to die. Paul said, we're all going to get through this alive. The centurion believes Paul. And so as a result, the centurion is not going to let anyone die, not Paul, not any of the prisoners. And so there's a part, I think there's somewhere in there that the centurion just knows, I can trust Paul to help me with this. So no, we're not going to execute the prisoners. If anything, Paul will see to the prisoners. And you know what? I almost believe that the prisoners themselves know they need to do the right thing. They know they shouldn't try to escape. They've seen Paul's own example. They're going to stick around and help too, I think. So you've got all these things coming together here, and I just really think the centurion has observed all this, and he just knows. No, we're going to do the right thing here. And we're all going to work together to get out of this. And so he starts issuing orders for an orderly escape. He says, "Any of you guys, anyone here know how to swim? Great, you guys go first." And notice he says, "Don't stick around to try and help the others. Just get to land. Swim as hard as you can and get to land. Because that's where we're going to need you. Because if any of these other guys get in trouble, we're going to need you helping out on land. That's where you're going to be able to help us the most." He says, "Any of you can swim, get off and get to the land. Don't wait around here." He says, "The rest of us, anyone else, find anything you can grab onto that'll float. And so they're grabbing boards and other pieces. Probably a big piece of the mast is floating around there. All these guys can grab onto a big chunk of the mast, and that'll float. So they're getting all these pieces. There are all these parts of the ship that are floating around. They're going to grab onto anything that they can get their hands on and hold on for dear life and trust that the current will wash you ashore." And that's exactly what happened. And look at what it says. Notice, everyone made it alive. All 276 people on board that ship, all 276 souls made it alive. And what God told Paul would happen, happened. He said, "You're going to get through this. Everyone's going to come through this alive." Was this God's Was this God determining this to happen? Yes, God knew what would happen. And God graciously intervened to help them through it. But you know what? Paul and everybody else had to do their part too, didn't they? They all had to do their part in order to come through this. And so that brings us to the end of our lesson for tonight. We will go to take some phone calls. I know we've got Paul waiting with us if anybody else wants to call in. Again, the phone number is area code 347-855-8317. You can log in using your Skype account. You can send us an email at mail@ttank.com. That's mail@ttank.com. Let's go ahead and bring on our guest with us. I believe, Paul, is that you there? You're on the air. Yeah, can you hear us okay? Excellent.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. How are we sounding tonight?
Wonderful.
Great.
Awesome.
Great.
Are you using the same broadband that you used last week?
No, I'm not. I'm actually using the 4G hotspot on the tablet.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to have a nice long chat with my internet provider because this is I've got plenty of bandwidth, but you know what? Every night at the same time, it always bogs down like this, and I don't know why. And I know it's not a traffic issue. They've got some technical issue going on with their infrastructure. And I don't know what causes it, but I think about around 9 or 10 o'clock, I'll do another speed check, and it'll be working just perfectly fine. So I don't know what's going on, why around 7 o'clock here it always starts running like a dog. But, oh, well, we've got an alternative, so we'll make use of it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're sounding like, better than Sean Hannity sounded on today.
Okay. Well, great.
Yeah. I mean, crystal clear.
Excellent.
So, yeah. So, great. And thanks for the lesson tonight. And I think even though that most of the lesson is narrative, boy, the way Luke writes all of that and the detail that's involved, it really enables you to put a picture in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And, you can really imagine how terrible the storm was, is if they had to determine how close they were to land by doing depth checks. I would think typically when you're on the sea, you would be able to see land from quite a far distance.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I did a little bit of research. Those help. From what I read on the more modern boats, now I don't know about, those older ones. I guess it was a huge stinking ship that 200-some people could fit on there.
Yes.
I mean, the thing's huge, right?
Yeah, so it's a sizable ship.
Yeah, there's videos on YouTube that show replicas of ancient ships like that, and the ones that I saw on YouTube were old pirate ships and merchant ships that hold about 150 people, and even they were absolutely gargantuan.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a big ship, and
You figure it's holding 276 people, plus all the cargo that they were hauling.
Yeah.
So you got to take that into consideration too.
So basically, you know, I know at least some of the helps were chains that went around from the front of the ship to the back of the ship, and they kind of wound it around the perimeter of the ship, okay, and then ratcheted them in, and I get, you know, I guess that kept the planks from coming undone or whatever, breaking apart. So, but you know, the detail and whatnot, I mean, I think there's purpose behind it. And, you know, it's really quite educational. You know, you learn all kinds of stuff about, you know, ancient shipping, and it's really quite interesting. And so, you know, but I'm kind of zonked tonight, so I'm not going to keep you long. I've done a lot of plumbing, did a lot of plumbing today, so I'm pretty worn out.
I hope you got a chance to go vote.
I didn't. I got in the middle of a I mean, I hated it, but I got in the middle of a plumbing job, and if I was going to get it, as it was, I showed up for the show 10 minutes late, and I was really wondering, you know, if I was going to be able to, but anyway, yeah, I got in the middle of this plumbing job, and the line in Greene County was just too long. And I went out in the middle of this plumbing job to get parts that I needed and intended to vote. But, you know, I would have been in line an hour or two, and I just didn't have it. So Susan was able to vote, and I guess, you know, she waited a long time, and of course it's all over this vote over the marijuana law or whatever. So anyway, next time I'll plan better, I guess. But at any rate, you know, you're right. If you look at if you're reading scripture through the historical redemptive method, you have no choice but to read salvation into the whole business with you know, you're not going to be saved unless you stay on the ship. Okay. And so I did a little bit of Googling, and it took all but 5 seconds to find a sermon that is all about, you know, keeping yourself saved by staying on the boat. I posted the link to it in the comment section on Blog Talk.
Okay, great. Excellent.
But the linchpin to the sermon is First Peter 1:5. That's the biggie. And you hear John Piper preach on this all the time. Okay? We are saved by the power of, or we are kept. We are kept by the power of God through faith. Okay? So we're kept by the power of God through faith. Okay, so in other words, we're kept by the power of God if you continue to live by faith. Okay, if you don't, so basically you're keeping yourself saved by keeping the faith. Okay, and you know, tempting to say, well, you know, Paul, if you deny God, doesn't it mean, you know, that you've lost your faith or blah, blah, blah? Well, now you got to define faith. What would they call saving faith? Well, you know, I can tell you this much. They're not going to tell you you have saving faith if you quit going to church.
You didn't stay in the ship.
Basically, it's clearly backdoor work salvation.
Mm-hmm.
It's clearly backdoor work salvation, you know. And Piper's really big on 1 Peter 1:5. You're kept by the power of God through faith. And of course, as we know, for Calvin and Luther, that meant by living in the Old Testament Sabbath rest.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So basically, I've said it before and I'll keep saying it, you keep yourself safe by not doing anything.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, but how do you not do nothing, Paul? Well, you know, here's how you don't do anything. And, you know, we laugh, but this is what they teach.
Yeah.
Okay? How do we live by doing nothing? Lest it be work salvation. Well, it's orthodoxy. There are work works and faith alone works.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And this is just identical to Judaism, okay, or the Judaizers, or the Pharisees. Absolutely identical, okay? Even in today's Judaism and Orthodox Judaism, okay, it's a sin to drive to a synagogue, but not to walk to a synagogue, okay?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, driving a car is work works. Walking, it's faith alone works. And my friend, it's absolutely no different from Protestant Orthodoxy.
Right.
Okay? They state it plainly when they talk about, quote, here it is, their terminology, not mine, means of grace. Means of grace. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The Lord's table. Baptism.
Yeah. Right. Those things. Right. That is their own. Those things have become their own tradition that has replaced the law. That in keeping those things, that is fulfilling the law, because those are the faith alone works that keep you in the ship.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I posted the link, and it's just too rich, so I'm going to do like I'm going to do a couple of special radio shows this week. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And, this article is just too easy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I want to do something on this article is because the guy uses sites, oh, I don't know, a multitude of scriptures. I mean, I don't know, let me see, right off the top of my head here, the guy makes his case with what, 30 or so scriptures? Okay, 30 or so verses or citations. So basically, you know, somebody's going to look at that and say, well, you can't tell me every one of those verses aren't saying what he's saying that they're saying, you know, because he's citing so many. So I think that for that reason, you know, I already breezed through of them, and it'll make for an interesting study because this is a great specimen. You know, it's a great specimen because of the number of verses that this guy uses. Okay, I'm going to be able to go through each and every verse and show where it's not saying what he's saying it's saying. So, you know, but anyway. Yeah, you know, when you mentioned that, I went ahead and did a little bit of Googling, and like I said, you can come up with quite a few examples.
Yeah, It doesn't take much work. I mean, this stuff's everywhere. Everywhere.
Right. Right. But anyway, great lesson. You sound great. And I'm going to let you go.
Okay.
And I hope Susan's not listening because I'm going to get a bowl of ice cream and I don't want her to know.
All right, then. I think I'm going to go.
I'm in Dayton and she's in Xenia. I assume she's probably listening. So.
Okay. Well, hopefully
she found the alternate link.
Yeah. Hopefully she found the alternate link because I had a problem with my broadcast at the beginning there, and I had one of those things where I got disconnected and it wouldn't let me reconnect because I was still logged in. So I basically had to kill the entire episode that I originally created, and I had to create a whole new one on the fly. So
okay.
That's the reason we're about 6 minutes late getting into it tonight. So
the next time that happens, try something.
Okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The next time that happens, refresh the page.
Yeah, I did that. It didn't work.
Really?
Yeah, it didn't work. Yeah.
Wow.
So.
Wow.
Anyway, we got it figured out. You found us okay. Hopefully everybody else will, if anybody else is trying to listen live. If not, you know, the podcast out there, I'll update the link to it on Paul's Passing Thoughts, and we'll be good to go. So.
Well, Susan changed Tank's data plan today because, you know, specifically for you to be able to use, you know, the Wi-Fi as a hot link. So, man, it sounds awesome. It's just so crystal clear.
Great.
So, at any rate, I'll let you go, brother. And
all right,
we'll be talking to you soon. And thanks for the great study.
You're welcome. Thanks for all your comments tonight. That was great.
Okay.
Have a great night. All right. All right, and with that, we will bring tonight's lesson to a close. Thank you all for joining in. Thank you for listening. Trust that the lesson was a blessing to you. Please join us again next week as we get into lesson 67. Two lessons left. Can you believe that? We've been doing this for two whole years now, and we're coming down to the last two lessons in the book, in our study of the book of Acts. And then we will move on to other things. Looking forward to that. Going to be sad to bring our Acts study to a close because I have certainly enjoyed this study myself and all the preparation work and everything, all the things that I have learned while I've been studying this and while I've been teaching it. And I trust that it's been a blessing to you as well. So we will see you next week, next Tuesday night, 7 o'clock. Join us for lesson 66. We will see you again, once again, at the Potter's House on Blog Talk Radio. Good night, everyone.